and that to sit on it is the symbol of the ultimate fulfillment of life is a mistake. Because if you do not get off of the cushion, the next man who wants it will have you carried away. You will not remain too long. The Chinese and the Hindus also decided that there was only one way of measuring value in space, and that value has something to do with permanence. Now, permanence in philosophy and in religion is not a little rock balancing forever in eternity in the same spot. Permanence is not a thing staying the same forever. Well, there's only one thing that can stay the same forever, and that is heaven. Because there is nothing that heaven is not. And heaven can never be less than itself. So there, heaven cannot change. But all other things do change. And they change in the process of becoming like or unlike heaven. Things that grow become more like heaven by changing. Things that regress become less like heaven by changing. But everything changes. Heaven is eternal, but it is also eternal motion, eternal life, eternal unfoldment, eternal becoming. The greatest permanence, therefore, is the individual being able to enter the systematic condition of forever becoming. This is his greatest possibility of permanence. And this possibility is bound to heaven and not to the earth. Out of the idea, then, of heaven, we now have heaven as origin, and heaven is ultimate, and earth is a little place between these two things. Earth is like maturity, suspended between childhood and old age. Earth is like that moment of success, suspended between the struggle to gain and the inevitable circumstance of loss. Earth is the momentary gratification, inevitably leading to pain, to sorrow, to loss, dissatisfaction, and the final necessity to relinquish all that has been achieved. The Chinese, consequently, believed that man must choose. He must choose by his own nature between heaven and earth. He must choose to follow heaven. And in order to follow heaven, he cannot directly imitate heaven. The Emperor of China might be the greatest man on earth, according to Chinese thinking at least, and he might have the most splendid symbols of temporal authority conceivable. But in the great ceremony of the fortunate New Year, the emperor, when he approached his own father, imperial heaven, had to cast off all his raiment of glory and come as a humble being in a plain white robe. In the same way, when the high priest of Israel entered into the Holy of Holies of the tabernacle or the temple, he could not wear his robes of glory. He had to come in a plain white robe as the symbol of humility. Man cannot achieve the state of heaven by copying the glory of the infinite. Man also is subservient to heaven. But there is a little difference between man and earth, because earth is heaven's queen. Earth, in a certain sense, is in eternal partnership with heaven. Heaven ordained earth and gave it its powers, bestowed upon it the authorities which it possesses. And in the union of these two, all fruitfulness came into existence. But man is not exactly a servant. Man is not some kind of a worm crawling on the earth who must forever humiliate himself. Heaven does not want man to debase himself, for in so doing he debases heaven within him. Heaven does not want man to be arrogant, for all arrogance is rebellion against heaven, whether heaven in the eternal or heaven in man himself. The Chinese believe that man was the son of heaven and earth. Therefore, that his relationships to his parents were governed by the infinite proprieties. And the great proprieties which regulated the conduct of China were philosophically and mystically interpreted to be the proper proprieties by which man would adjust himself to the universal pattern to which he belonged. The good book that we know tells us to honor the father and mother. This was the will of heaven also in China. To honor the father, not only the physical parent who is the symbol of heaven, but the eternal parent who is heaven. Man must therefore honor heaven and earth. And in honoring heaven and earth, he is honoring his father and his mother. And according to Chinese psychology, when he honors his father and mother, he honors heaven and earth. For the lesser becomes the symbol of the greater. And the great pattern of analogies cannot be violated anywhere, on any level, without endangering the validity of the entire pattern so far as man's conscious life is concerned. The proprieties, therefore, regulate all of the relationships by means of which man must approach heaven. Confucius was not what we would term a devout man. I think a great many Confucian scholars have missed, however, that under the moral and ethical system of Confucianism, there is actually the shadow of the great Chinese theology. Confucius honored of all things and above all things the I Ching, the great classic of changes, which was nothing more or less than an involved and complicated Kabbalistic exposition of the various unions of heaven and earth. Therefore, in man's relationship with these polarities, these problems that arise, he is represented in the Chinese concept as a youth of filial proprieties and filial devotions. When he takes certain attitudes towards both heaven and earth, in the presence of heaven, he must always be respectful. In the presence of earth, he must always be considerate. In the presence of earth, he must forever consider. For it is through the consideration of earth that man comes to understand nature. It is only when very quietly, and like a good child, he sits at the knee of his great mother and listens to the instruction of the ages, that he begins his life well. It is only through becoming inwardly aware of all the principles and operations and processes of nature that man actually pays respect to the great mother. It is the great mother who teaches him. She is the beginning of the university. She is life with its great pattern of experiences. And no matter how old the son becomes, he will never be as old as his mother. no matter how quickly he gets to the top of Fool's Mountain, no matter how brilliantly his adolescence seems to be, he must ultimately bow his head again and return to the wisdom of the mother, because she represents all of the acceptances which make up the life of the wise. Nature is forever revealing the will of heaven. Nature is forever obedient to the will of heaven. And nature, in every move and action, is strangely true, fanatically true, to the spiritual power of God. Thus, in this we have the deportment, which according to Confucius was the relationship of family, father, mother, son, or father, mother, daughter. This great unity. Man must never profane the mother, must never fail to provide for her, must never under any conditions leave her open to need. At the same time, he must give reverence to the father. He must always recognize the father as the leader. When the man is 70 and the father is 90, the duties of filial piety are not changed. These duties are based not upon human relationships, but are merely the human interpretation of the soul's relationship with space. Now, in the material sense of the word, where parents are not always as wise as heaven and earth, well, in many cases, children have not too much to respect their parents for. It is not easy, perhaps, to fulfill the old Chinese requirement as far as filial relationships are concerned. But the symbolism is the important thing. For it is the symbol that binds man's conduct to the cosmos. If man is forever thoughtful of the earth, forever kind to it, it also means that he is harmless to all these creatures that, like himself, are the children of the same mother. All peoples are the children of the great mother. She will defend them, and she does defend them without partiality to the end. She has no favorite sons. She has no outcasts. She turns away from none. The rain falls upon the just and the unjust. All things in nature are absolutely fair, operating upon a simple merit system. Man must learn this. For when he breaks this rule, the old Chinese moral code is, he breaks the heart of his mother. And where he does these things, it is not good for him. The mother of Mencius is one of the immortals of Chinese literature, Chinese history, because she is the one who made the three steps to protect her son. These three steps were three changes of residence, in order that the boy might be removed from a place of bad influences or inferior influences, the mother being constantly mindful of the need to protect her son from wrong association. The same thought occurs in the proprieties. The three steps of the great mother are very simple. To provide all that lives with the materials of existence. To provide all that lives with means of unfolding character and integrity. And instilling by example into all that lives respect and affection for God. These are the contributions that the mother makes to the life of the child. Now, as the Confucian code turns to heaven, how shall heaven be honored? One is that no man shall ever, under any condition, humiliate his father. He shall never, behind his father's back, criticize him or condemn him. Furthermore, whether his father is right or not, the duties of filial piety require that he be respectful, that he be thoughtful. And though he be many times injured, he must not injure in return. This is no more than the Sermon on the Mount, but it is applied a little differently. Because now it does not apply merely to the earthly father, but to heaven. To the Chinese, the greatest of all filial sins, we might say, would be to deny the father. To deny that a certain parent is your father is to be cast off utterly into oblivion. To deny the eternal father is therefore to deprive oneself of a tremendous internal strength, which we are beginning to sense now, although we didn't realize this a few years ago. To honor heaven is to obey heaven. And in the Chinese family, obedience is mandatory. In the cosmos, obedience is also mandatory. For the wise man must obey heaven, must in all things follow in every way that he can the way of heaven. And how shall he attain the knowledge of this way? And that is, must be, as always, through the example of his parents. The human man receives certain instruction through the example of his parents. All humanity, children of heaven and earth, are also instructed by the examples of heaven and earth. And the Chinese point out that among these examples are absolute justice, absolute law, eternal patience, and continual everlasting forgiveness. These are the way of heaven. Man may err, but heaven is great enough to accept the error of man without condemnation. Man may temporarily wander from home like the prodigal son, but heaven can wait. Heaven can wait until man returns. The individual may regard himself as far wiser than his father, knowing much more than heaven about everything. Heaven again can wait. Because man can change and find out the truth, but heaven has nothing to change, so it can simply wait. It can wait because in eternity there is no time. And whether it takes the man a year or 1,000 lives to awaken, not either one is but an instant in eternity. So there is no hurry. There is only need for the perfect learning of the lesson. Now, in the same way that there are responsibilities of man to heaven, the family also reveals the responsibilities of heaven and earth to man. There are proprieties for parents also. And these proprieties cannot be violated in their turn. For all parenthood must be copied from the way of heaven. The imperial power of heaven is never impatient, never unjust, never partial, never revengeful. The imperial power of heaven has no favorites. It leaves out none. It condemns nothing. It criticizes nothing. It simply remains itself. And by so doing, ultimately draws all else unto itself. Heaven never has to apologize. Heaven never needs to be angry. For anger is a sign of weakness, and heaven is strong. Heaven never needs to defend itself, for heaven is never aware that it is weak in anything. Therefore, not needing to defend itself, it does not need to talk back, to argue. It does not need to strike down the unjust man with lightning. Nor does it need to take the beliefs of men and condemn them by a voice from the sky. Heaven does not interfere with the foolishness of men, because there is no need to. Heaven can wait. And by waiting, heaven fulfills its greatest duty. For man finally comes to heaven. Coming to the presence of his Father in a proper manner, respectfully. Coming also like the prodigal son returning to his father's house, aware of his own shortcomings, and very grateful when light does break that the father did not force light upon him. This quiet, inevitable control is the way of heaven. Heaven does not take part in elections. Heaven does not interfere with the conspiracies of men, because heaven knows that all conspiracies must lead in time to those experiences which will bring man back to heaven. Everything ends in reality. And heaven, being reality, accepts into itself everything that awakens to truth. So earth is a little stage on which actors walk about playing their varied parts. And everyone is audience to everyone else. The master of the show is heaven. And all the plays are little miracle productions, little sacred dramas, little fable stories, legends, myths, every one of them relating to the mysteries of heaven and earth. Every hero and every heroine is heaven and earth again, and every villain is the ignorance of the human mind. So these work out together. Hero, heroine, villain, heaven, earth, and man. And it is up to man to restore, restate his own true nature. In other words, he must one of these days be a reformed villain. Heaven in this sense then becomes in a magnet. And as the Indian yogis know, man approaches heaven by being unlike everything except heaven. Man must come into some kind of relationship with heaven. This relationship can be internal, but having been established internally, it becomes eternal. So man, in his meditation, meditates, if he does so correctly, in terms of the Chinese proprieties. He comes simply and quietly as a son returning to his father's house. He realizes that it is his eternal birthright to go home, to be one with truth. He realizes that he is not asking some special favor. He is not an uncast, a para, who must beg for the privilege of being saved. He is by his eternal nature saved always. The only thing he is asking for is that he may have the insight to know that he is saved and how. Therefore he comes into the presence of the disciplines with perfect security of consciousness. He knows that that which he desires is his birthright, that it was his before the beginning of the world, that all he is doing is asking respectfully as a son, whose birthright has been established, that he may receive that birthright. And in order to receive it, he must perform the proprieties. He must reestablish within himself the true relationship between man and heaven, the simple, natural, honorable relationship, a relationship that was probably better experienced by peasants and artisans and agriculturists and shopkeepers than by those who had the higher intellectual attainments. Those who could simply interpret the duty of the son to the father had the secrets of yoga. For these duties were duties kindly given from a deep affection. Man approaches deity because of a deep respect, regard, affection for reality. He finds himself yearning after righteousness. And as his nature naturally unfolds, its kindness, its thoughtfulness, he knows when he must bow his head to the eternal. And he is one of these creatures that must achieve through acceptances. He cannot demand. He cannot say that enlightenment is his by divine right. He can't say it for two reasons. First, because he cannot demand it. And the second place is that it is his already, but not in the arrogant and aggressive way that he thinks. It is only by this quietude that he can break through the barrier of his own sophistication, his own mental arrogance. Zen tells us the same thing. Vedanta tells us the same thing. That acceptance mystically is to allow the experience of the infinite to move in upon our own consciousness. In this way, we share with earth the life of heaven. When in our own thinking, heaven moves us, we are one with heaven. So the ancient Chinese, mingling their thoughts with the early Hindu Buddhists who came to China, developed this idea of the individual being utterly and completely moved by the infinite. Moved by something he could not define. Moved by the power that Lao Tzu tells us about, this way of heaven, Tao. Moved by the eternal rhythm of the infinite. And this rhythm is the rhythm of eternal obedience. Man being like the little ship floating upon the stream. The motion of the ship, the rocking of the ship, everything determined by the water. Man on the surface of the river of Tao floats along the way of heaven, the way of law, trusting in entirely and completely in heaven itself. This is the perfect acceptance of meditation. This is the power that was referred to as the eighth step in the Mahaparinirvana. For in it, Buddha, approaching dissolution, finally reached the state where he cast off even the power to cast off. Renounced in himself the power to renounce, and trusted himself completely in the substance of a totally unconditioned state. This was the total acceptance. This is undoubtedly the basis of the concept that he who loses his life for truth shall find it again. But he who tries to save his life will lose it. So heaven says, if you lose your life for my sake, you will have life everlasting. It is the acceptance which then permits the complete identification of the individual with the universal. His rebellion is the barrier between himself and truth. As this rebellion ceases in him, he becomes one with the truth that always was. The acceptance of heaven is the ultimate act of filial piety. It is the Son acknowledging the Father. And this is a dignified, ritualistic procedure in Chinese life. The Father would never think of humiliating his Son. He would never think of condemning his Son, no matter what might be in his heart or mind. He might find ways of subtly communicating in some way, through a third person perhaps, his grave anxieties about his Son. But the Father will not break the proprieties either. Heaven will never be less than heaven in order to please men. Heaven will never thunder to prove to man that heaven exists. Heaven will wait until man discovers the fact for himself. So out of this polarity of heaven and earth, which the ancients interpreted in so many ways, comes the concept of the great cosmic family, and also man's final course of decision. There are mystics who have also realized, by the way, that complete union with the earth is also complete union with heaven. Thus in yoga, there is not only Raja Yoga, or the path of princely union, but there is also Kama Yoga, the complete forgetting of self in the service of the human need. The individual can either forget himself in meditation in the presence of God, or he can forget himself by complete absorption into the problem of human consciousness. He can achieve it by absolutely losing self in service. And this is where the Northern School of Buddhism developed its bodhisattva concept. The grand notion being that man can never know God until he forgets himself. He can forget himself in meditation, or he can forget himself in complete dedication to the needs of others. In both cases, the barrier of self is reduced. And in this way, the power of heaven is released or expressed through this life. Heaven manifests when self ceases to arbitrarily determine truth and error. So that the moment man forgets that he wants to be saved, he finds salvation. When in the search for salvation, he desires only truth, and the unselfish loss of himself in eternity, he then also becomes a mystic. But whatever it is, man must accept heaven. And by whatever way he accepts heaven, either through consciousness or through dedication to duty, he achieves the end which he desires. And that is that he achieves in himself the reunion of earth and heaven. For ultimately, the earth as a power must go back to heaven, and all things earthy must return to their heavenly origin. The great deity must finally be reunited completely. And man, in his own achievement, foreshadows this ultimate union. And in so doing, probably fulfills most of the latent symbolism in this great polarized concept. Well, time is up, so I think we'll have to stop for this evening.